The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. The cream of British screen acting visits the show this week. I meet actress Emily Watson to discuss her role in Steven Spielberg's adaptation of War Horse. And Ralph Fiennes releases his directorial debut, an adaptation of Shakespeare's Coriolanus, a tale of power, war, and betrayal. I discuss the challenge of starring and directing this thorny political tragedy. Myself and Guardian critic Zan Brooks will be reviewing the week's other big releases, as well as War Horse. We've got Michael Fassbender and Carey Mulligan in Shame, and Jeremy Irons and Kevin Spacey, among others, in Margin Call. When it comes to film podcasts, it's a one-horse race. It's Film Weekly. These days, more and more West End theatres stage adaptations of big hit movies to get bums on seats. But War Horse has the reverse pedigree, a stage phenomenon based on a novel that is now a screen epic under the auspices of none other than Steven Spielberg. With a largely British cast, the film tells of a young West Country lad, Albert, and his horse, Joey, sold for the war effort and their epic struggle to reunite, survive, and return home from the World War I trenches. Actress Emily Watson, last seen in Jim Loach's heart-wrenching Oranges and Sunshine, plays Albie's stoic mother, Rose Narricot, and I was thrilled to meet up with her to discuss her role in both of those fine films. But first, let's hear her in action in Spielberg's War Horse.
What have you done?
That's Mooney's call.
You were supposed to buy a plough horse.
You bought him.
What'd you pay for him? How much, Ted Narricot?
I won't tell you a lie, though I would love to. 30 guineas.
30 guineas? He's not worth 10. Are you out of your mind? What about the rent?
He's a strong one, Rosie. Look at the way he holds his head.
How the hell are we going to pull anything with that? Ted, you have to take him back. You have to take him back right now. You have to get down on your knees and beg for our money back.
No. No, please, don't take him back. I'll train him.
Oh, you stay out of this, Albie. You don't know nothing about horses.
Please, Mum. Please let me, I can do it.
Right. Well, you've got 1 month to break him in or I'm taking him back myself.
Congratulations on War Horse. What a wonderful project to be involved with. Was that something that you knew about for ages? Because, I mean, you know, you play the mother character, I suppose, and it's not so much, you know, it's her son's story and a horse's story and a war's story. But we needed you from the first, you know, from the off. Were you always involved?
Yes, I think, yes. I mean, I've been aware of this from when I first saw the play at the National. And so it's had a real royal progress, this project. I mean, the book is a much, much loved children's story. And Michael Marpurgo is hero worshipped at my daughter's school, mm-hmm. I think. And I saw the show at the National, and then, you know, it was fallen in love with by an iconic American filmmaker, and he's made it into a great big Hollywood movie. Mm. And last night we had the premiere here in London. We kind of brought it home, and it was a real sense of occasion. Yeah. And it feels such a proudly British subject. It's so British. That sense of the terrible loss and grief of the First World War was such a huge bruise on our national psyche. And to shine a light on it now, when it really is passing from living memory. Michael Marpurgo has talked very eloquently about how the story came out of his hearing tales from old soldiers about the trenches and how angry he was at the terrible waste of life and what happened to the horses.
Yeah. And that's where your family comes in a way, because the small village that gets decimated, I suppose, by the war. You feel it more keenly in a smaller community, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a story that was replicated across the land. Every village you go to in England has a First World War memorial, and, you know, a clutch of young men died in every village.
And a horse.
And horses, indeed. I mean, a lot of the horses never came back.
Yeah. The performance that you put in, it's the mother's. The mother's sense, I suppose, of this loss as well, but not just for her. You've got a horse and a son to worry about.
Yeah, I think she's a woman who's very aware of the damage that war causes. In the way that it's conceived in the film, her husband is has a bad leg and he's a drunk because he has been damaged by a previous war, and she understands that, and she's trying to keep the family together and protect him, in a sense, from himself, and have her son learn some respect for what his father's been through, which he ultimately does in a very, very difficult way, which is to look down the barrel of the same gun and go to war.
You mentioned before that Steven Spielberg has turned into a big Hollywood epic, which he has in a way. The bits that you're in that reference, I think, old movies in a way, the films that Steven Spielberg loved growing up, such as The Quiet Man or even old westerns. Did he tell you what look he was going for? Because with Janusz Kaminski, they've even shot it in that kind of sort of burnished, overlit kind of 50s way.
We didn't specifically talk about that, but I was very aware that it was, you know, very architecturally designed shots, that things were really landing in a very specific emotional way, and there were moments of impact, and, you know, it wasn't a kind of organic free-for-all, let's just see what happens and try and film it.
Does that change your performance? Is that something that you can sort of say, well, if I'm doing, say, Lars von Trier, I'll be naturalistic, or if I'm doing Jim Loach, I'll be a certain way. Do you work with the director on that aspect?
You very specifically respond to what they're doing and try and give them what they need for how them putting together their picture. And Stephen does a very specific thing, which is he will, quite often in a close-up, he will talk to you and talk about what you might be thinking as you're filming. So that he's planting little seeds in your head as you're going along, and you can see these things, you know, lighting up people's faces that he's saying.
And you'd never worked with anyone doing that before?
No, I hadn't. It was very interesting.
Mm. Is it off-putting?
At first, a bit off-putting, but actually, after a while, I really enjoyed it.
It does come across, and it's interesting that she has some of her best scenes with knitting needles. You know, threatens David Thewlis with a knitting needle, which she wanted to do for ages. there's a metaphor there, because she sort of knits the community together as well.
Yes, I think there's a little touch of the Penelopes there. She's at home with her loom, waiting for the men to return. But that sense of, that was great actually, having that really, really angry, was kind of that whole pouring with rain, yelling at people in the rain. I love that.
Yeah.
Very elemental.
Yeah. No, it was. And that's where the sort of film takes a turn from the sort of colourful, lyrical, pastoral thing to this kind of muddy, more elemental, a bit more like Andrea Arnold's Wuthering Heights.
Right, yes. Very fiery nature coming out there.
Yeah. It's interesting to compare this performance. I mentioned Oranges and Sunshine because I have to tell you that, you know, I cried a bit, but Oranges and Sunshine earlier this year, I was in buckets for the whole film. What a fantastic film, what a fantastic performance. We had Jim Loach on the show, didn't have you on the show, right. So didn't get a chance to thank you for that one.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, that was, I mean, that is very, very potent stuff as well. I mean, in a way, it's similar territory. It's about children who are separated from their parents, and that there's nothing more gut-wrenching.
Mm.
And those very real, real people who are, you know, they're all alive still, and a lot of them never reunited with their families. And to me, what was so shocking, that people here weren't aware of that story.
Yeah, no, I wasn't at all. I mean, that's why I was just in Mecca. I couldn't believe that this had happened. And I understand, I didn't know this, but I can say you lost your mother, for which I'm very sorry, during the filming of that. I mean, I don't know, I couldn't contain myself watching it. I think it must have added an extra layer of sadness or to your performance, or control, I suppose. That's what the breaking point is.
Yeah, I mean, that was very, very hard. And a lot of the time when I watch the movie, I can just see myself trying to keep it together, because every scene was about your mum, you know, talking about somebody's mum. Mm. And the scene where Hugo Weaving, I tell him that his mother has been traced and has recently died and they will never be reunited, was utterly heartbreaking. He was so brilliant. That was the first scene I did when I got back to Australia after my mama died. And he was so beautiful and so brilliant, and I will always remember him in that.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Well, I can't forget him in that. He was out from the sea, and then just the distance, it was just extraordinary. So two heartbreaking films that you've done this year, Emily Watson. When you've been in a musical next.
Oh, yes, please, somebody send me a comedy now.
This woman is funny, don't forget. Emily, really lovely to have you on the show. Congratulations on both.
Thank you very much, thank you.
And War Horse in all its equine glory can be seen on the biggest of screens around the UK from this Friday, the 13th of January. Now, Now, ponying up is Guardian film critic Zan Brooks. Why the long face?
Oh, oh, oh. Is this the main event now?
It really is. We won't be here for long. Zan, we'll be looking at War Horse. We'll also be looking at Shame, starring Michael Fassbender and Kerry Mulligan. We'll also look at Margin Call. We had the director on the show last week, but we shall review the film with Jeremy Irons and Paul Bettany and Kevin Spacey and that great cast in that indie film, as well as we look at the films of the week. But we'll start with War Horse. We heard from Emily Watson there. Zan, your impressions of the film, please. And I'm looking for a little bit more than two nods of the head and a stamp of the hoof.
Oh, really? Oh, okay. Well, that's my forte. I like this considerably more than I was anticipating.
Ah, so did I.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's because of a poor review in this paper.
Yes, possibly it was, that neither of us were responsible for. And maybe it's also because of Tintin, which I was expecting to like and then really didn't.
Yeah, I didn't like that one either.
The creepy dead eyes of the mocap put me off. I found the horse eminently more relatable to than the zombies in Tintin.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because everyone knows from the play of War Horse that it was this magical puppet experience. And I thought when Spielberg was doing it, and then he was doing Tintin, I thought, oh, God, he's going to use that, almost that mocap to do the horse in some way, kind of translate the magic of the theatre into the... But he doesn't. He's done it sort of as straight as you could possibly
straight.
Do it.
It's very old-fashioned. I mean, it's old-fashioned both in its technique, I guess. It's the real boy in his, you know, in his horse-type movie.
Yeah.
And it's old-fashioned in the storytelling. It's obviously harking back to kind of John Ford. It's got the sort of the slight John Ford, How Green Was My Valley view of the English countryside.
I was thinking
here.
Of The Quiet Man, which put John Wayne in Ireland and Margaret Sullivan, but it was actually in E.T., in that scene when E.T. is drinking the beer that it features in there. So there's obviously the lighting, the Janusz Kaminski cinematography at that point, the early point, really looked like, you know, old.
Yeah, it's like the
British.
Whole film has been dipped in butterscotch, hasn't it? It's got that kind of honeyed glow to it that is a bit cheesy, is a bit corny. I think some of the dialogue was incredibly clunky. And perhaps one of the reasons why I related to the horse so well was because compared to some of the two-legged characters, the horse is the most rounded, convincing protagonist there. You've got the, you know,
he looked good on the red carpet as well.
He looked good. He did look very good. Yeah, he behaved himself. He didn't leave any deposits. You've got, you know, Albert, who's the homespun farm lad who loves his horse. You've got Tom Hiddleston as the noble captain. You've got Niels Aristrup as the kindly grandfather. Although Niels Aristrup we remember from Un Prophète, where he plays the terrifying Caesar in the prison. So each time he was on there with the little girl, I kept thinking he's going to stab that little girl.
It was weird, isn't it? Because Spielberg's obviously chosen Niels Aristrup, that guy who was so brilliant in Un Prophète. He can't have seen much of his work elsewhere.
No.
And he's chosen him to be the kind of kindly French grandfather in this French episode bit of the film, and it's kind of really bizarre casting because you just do think he's going to attack his
granddaughter
with a spoon.
He's got the cold eyes of a killer, hasn't he?
I mean, I actually think he was one of the best things, didn't he? You mention all those characters, and you could have mentioned Benedict Cumberbatch with his kind of World War One moustache. It's episodic in its way. You have the early start with the horse in
early
Devon.
Start on Dartmoor with the thatch cottage in the lower field, and Emily Watson and Peter Mullen. From there, you go through an amazing, you know, Spielberg is great at these big set pieces.
Yeah.
And you've got the cavalry charge across the open plain into the enemy camp and then into the woods behind, which is done absolutely brilliantly. After which the horse is trapped behind enemy lines and then finds his way through the very circuitous and, it has to be said, an incredibly long-winded way back.
But he's loved by a boy in Dartmoor, and then he's loved by German soldier boy who
he gets a lot of loving. This horse, he gets almost as much loving as Michael Fassbender does in another film.
In another way, in another shape. I'd like to see the two combined, but I don't think they have a rating for such things yet. Or maybe that's Equus coming up with Spielberg and Fassbender together. And then there's this French episode, which I have to say, it's so self-contained, I could have done without it.
Yeah.
I would have cut out this kind of another girl. She was a kind of brattish French, because I didn't like her at all. I don't know if she was an American doing a French accent or a bit of both. That bit seemed to me sort of totally unnecessary, because it's a long film. We're looking at 146 minutes, you know, it's much longer than the Grand National. And I think that I think it's a kid's film in a way, and I'm not sure that they've got the patience for it all.
Well, it's a kid's film, but it's a war film, and that seems an odd mix. And I think Spielberg does show a kind of restraint that it does have the big set pieces, but it isn't Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
You don't see blood and gore and body parts. It's a lot of the horrors are sort of taken taking place sort of off screen a little bit, which I thought worked.
It did. I mean, it's a bit Pipes of Peace.
You've got the reprise of the football game in No Man's Land, but in this case, it's a German soldier and an English soldier who meet up with wire cutters to free the horse from barbed wire, which is again cheesy as hell, and yet it kind of has it's effective.
Very
it,
powerfully
it worked.
Done. Very brilliantly. Very well shot, and it worked very well. Yeah, there is a great skill at work here, and I enjoyed the film a lot more than I thought I was going to. And I thought
it was heartfelt. I thought that Tintin was like a kind of Spielberg doing a technical exercise. Let's see if I can do this. And there was no Spielbergian heart or soul in it at all. This, for all of its flaws, and it isn't a great film, I thought that he believed in it, and because of that, it carried me along.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. And, and everyone was heartfelt in it, from Peter Mullen to David Thewlis and Emily Watson, and, of course, the horse, Joey. Zan, thank you very much. We shall gallop on to Shame. Now, you mentioned there's a lot of love in Shame. This stars, of course, Michael Fassbender as a sex addict, Brandon, in New York. Here he is, wanting his sister, Carey Mulligan, to start taking responsibility for her own life.
Stop playing the victim.
I'm not playing the victim. If I left, I would never hear from you again. Don't you think that's sad? Don't you think that's sad? You're my brother.
Why is it always so dramatic with you? Everything is always the end of the world.
It's not dramatic. I'm trying to talk to you.
I don't want to talk. Try not talking. Try just listening or thinking for a change.
Because that's working great for you. You're completely fine.
I've got my own apartment.
Oh, you have your own apartment. That's amazing. You have a job and an apartment. I should be in awe of you.
Well, at least I'm responsible for it. At least I don't depend on people all the time. You're a dependency. You're a parasite.
You don't have anybody. You don't have anybody. You have me and your pervert boss.
You slept with that pervert boss. What does that make you?
Don't talk to me about sex life, Brandon. Not from you.
Well, a full and frank conversation. It's not the only full and frank shot in the film, is it, Dan?
It's really not. This is an explicit film about sex that somehow manages to be utterly unsexy, which I think is a tribute to Steve McQueen, who's entirely in charge of his... He's master of his own domain in this film, isn't he? He knows what he's doing.
Yeah. You say it's unsexy. Perhaps it's more unerotic.
Unerotic, you're
because
right.
I think there is sexiness there.
Yeah, it's unarousing, though,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, unarousing. I personally don't fancy Michael Fassbender.
No, that's...
But if I did, and I know there are many people out there who do, that might be... An extra charge.
Well, it's the tricky issue, isn't it, that does film glamorise everything that it looks at, whether that is violence or sex? Mm. And you can slap the cautionary message on, but of course some people are still going to get off on it. And maybe that's an interesting aspect of the film, and it is about the debasement of sex in the current culture. There's a line from the Carey Mulligan character where she says, "We're not bad people, we just come from a bad place." And the implication is that place is the world where sex has just been traded so heavily that these people are just jaded, and they're using it as the equivalent of sort of shock therapy to sort of feel something. But it isn't about intimacy, it isn't about human relationships at all. It's almost a way of keeping people at bay.
It's about loneliness as well, I suppose the cheap temptation of which we have in life, and but the click of a mouse, you know, pornography is on the computer.
I mean, the Brandon character.
I understand that it is.
You can hunt it down, apparently.
I don't know.
And the Brandon character has, you know, a procession of women coming through his bedroom and all kinds of filth on his hard drive at work.
Yeah.
Where the boss is kind of listing them and he says, cream pies, and I don't even know what that is.
And then, of course, the boss is more lascivious than he, wanting to kind of have affairs.
Yeah, everybody's slightly corrupted and soiled in this.
Yes,
film.
Even from the women who take one look at Michael Fassbender and think, well, you know, I'll go home with him, and they know they shouldn't. There is that kind of look. And I think those are brilliantly handled in the film, those looks across spaces. I think he's very good at tight spaces, Steve McQueen, in the train carriage.
Yeah, you're right. It's that sterility. It's a film that almost takes place in a vacuum, that the air has all been sucked out of it, and you find yourself kind of gasping for breath through it all. It's not a film that I would particularly want to see again, because it is so intensely claustrophobic. But I'm really really glad I saw it, and I think it's a tremendous movie and a masterclass of acting, both from Fassbender, who's obviously getting all the attention, but also from Kerry Mulligan. I think it's possibly the best role that I've seen her do.
Yeah, very nice to see her doing this.
As the kind of needy, damaged, brittle sister who wants to be a singer, but you know isn't quite going to make
it. Yeah, even though he gives her a big moment.
Yeah, and she's good.
A full New York blues style, full song, and not the cutaway after 10 bars, you know, the whole number. And it's very powerful. There's also a brilliant running scene across through New York, down the street. And, you know, I just think that there's a lot going on here to talk about.
Yeah.
He said in an interview with me last week that it becomes an object. It's almost like a sculpture and you can walk around
it.
You might not like all of it.
You're right. And that's his pedigree as a visual artist. You know, I thought that this was more successful than his previous film, Hunger, which I felt was a little bit too wedded to the concepts of the art installation. Mm. It felt too thought through and mannered. I think that this is weirdly looser and more real. And because of that, I found it utterly absorbent.
Yeah, I do too. Even the sort of wild and whirling bits towards the end, the climaxes, there are various kind of tangents where involve beating up and go into a sort of a sordid club. And then a slightly neat tying up, but it's not neatly tied up.
No,
we
not
think
at
it's
all.
Going to that way. And it frustrates expectations in that. And I think all the better for it. It's a very, very, very powerful piece of work. I don't know whether I like it as such, but I'm not sure I like it necessarily.
But you know, without contradicting myself, I think it's the first great film of the year.
Yeah, absolutely, and definitely worth talking about. No shame in seeing shame. Zan, an indie film has come our way, Margin Call. We had the director, J.C. Shandor, on the show last week telling us how he got this cast together, and it is a fabulous cast, including Jeremy Irons, who here plays the boss of this investment bank, the respected investment bank, and he finds out that, indeed, it is all going down the pan, and he tells Kevin Spacey to get on with it.
The real question is, who are we selling this to?
Same people we've been selling it to for the last 2 years, and whoever else will buy it.
But, John, if you do this, you will kill the market for years. It's over. And you're selling something that you know has no value.
We are selling to willing buyers at the current fair market price, so that we may survive.
You will never sell anything to any of those people ever again.
I understand.
Do you?
Do you? This is it. I'm telling you, this is it.
Shades there of Glengarry Glen Ross, only because maybe Kevin Spacey's in it, and maybe because David Mamet could have written this.
I think so, and maybe because J.C. Chandler has perhaps studied a lot of David Mamet. It's got the rat-a-tat dialogue. Yeah. It's got the anguish, desperate men in little rooms.
And indeed, estate agents were the villains of the 90s, I think.
Yeah, and investment bankers are.
Yeah, investment
bankers
certainly are the baddies du jour.
Journalists next decade, Jess.
I think you're right, mate. Yeah, who's going to play you? Jeremy Irons, I think, would be great.
I think he'd be very good, wouldn't he? Yeah. I think he's got the right kind of gravitas.
I liked him very much here.
He's very good in this. He plays a character called Tuld, who is supposedly not to be confused with a guy called Dick Fuld, who was, I think, the CEO of Lehman Brothers at one stage. So obviously this is just a shuffle step away from the news headlines. It plays out, I think, in a kind of 36-hour period during the 2008 crash.
It's sort of the night of the crash, isn't it?
It's the night of the crash.
Things can be distilled into such a moment.
Yes.
Maybe they can.
I think they can, and I think this does this very well. And then within that, it shows that the hierarchy of this investment bank and also the degrees of amorality that you've got Stanley Tucci as the guy with the conscience who sort of blows the whistle by handing the USB to Zachary Quinto. You've got a really great performance from Kevin Spacey, the best performance I've seen on screen from him in a couple of years, I think. As almost, you know, what is he? He's the sort of the risk analyst or something. Who again discovers he has a conscience, and then
he's a sort of decentish fellow.
He's a decentish guy because he's worried about his dog that's dying, which is the real symbol of, you know, the dog is America, I guess, in this film. And then you've got Jeremy Irons at the top who swoops in the helicopter and is all about ring fencing, you know, the assets of, you know, not even the top 1%, the top sort of 0.00%.
Yeah, no. It's interesting because what I liked about the film was that it's very clear, even though talking about it, I don't quite know who did what and what a fund manager and a risk analyst
I
are.
No idea.
But yet, while I was in the world of the film, it was piercingly clear in the way that Charles Bergson's Inside Job was clear and set out. You understand how this thing could have happened.
Yeah, and it dramatises it, which is no mean feat, I think. By its nature, it's a film within that little goldfish bowl. There's no sense of America outside.
Sure, how can you make a film about these loathsome people who we love to hate?
Well, I think you know, at times I was almost resisting it because it is humanizing them. Mm. It is humanizing them. It's saying they're not all bad people. They're just working in perhaps a fundamentally toxic profession.
Place.
Yes, they come
America,
from a bad place.
Ivy League schools.
And, you know, it's what else are they to do? If you make that decision to work in this industry, these are the compromises that, that corrupt you on a day-by-day-by-day
exactly.
basis.
Exactly, and we have the Zachary Quinto character, who was a rocket scientist, of clearly intelligent, and he sort of says, well, the money's much better here.
Yeah.
And this is the pact that you make with that.
That's the pact that you
mammon.
Make, and maybe that is, maybe you're damned from making that that initial decision. Mm. But once you've made that decision, how then do you live with yourself, and how then do you respond in a crisis when what you're, the assumptions that you're making all fall apart, and you find that your firm is basically built on toxic waste?
Yeah, absolutely. I I'm very surprised.
I think it's very good.
I really, really enjoyed it, and it's kind of one of the most enjoyable kind of just pure out, because it's not too difficult to get.
Nope.
And the morality is fairly simple in it. But
and there's something inherently thrilling about seeing successful people on the abyss.
Yeah, exactly. That's why
give
I come
a little
in here
nudge.
Every week, Zan, and speak to you. As ever, Zan, thank you very much indeed for your reviews. For a comprehensive list of reviews, day or night, and much, much more, go to the best film site in the English language, guardian.co.uk/film.
What's the matter? You dissentious rogues that rubbing the poor itch of your opinion make yourselves scabs.
We have ever your good word.
He that will give good words to thee will flatter beneath abhorring. What would you have, you curs, that like nor peace nor war? The one affrights you, the other makes you proud. He that trusts to you, where he should find you lions, finds you hares, where foxes, geese. Who deserves greatness deserves your hate.
The steely voice of British actor Ralph Fiennes there in a scene from his directorial debut, an adaptation of Shakespeare's Coriolanus. The story is a searing political drama with a typical Shakespearean arc, taking the seemingly valiant Roman general Caius Marcius to the heights of power, whereon he takes the name Coriolanus. Only later, he falls from grace amid a mire of revenge inspired by popular opinion. With a top-flight cast, including Jerry Butler, Jennifer Chastain, Brian Cox, and Vanessa Redgrave, Fiennes' adaptation has a visceral action movie edge, shot by the acclaimed British cinematographer Barry Ackroyd, who recently filmed The Hurt Locker, in which Fiennes memorably featured. Having already performed in a critically acclaimed London stage production of the play in 2000, when I met up with Ralph, I began by asking him that it must have seemed like a good idea to take on a text that he knew so intimately.
Yes, that's true, but also I knew it was very ambitious to try and take this play of Shakespeare's, not most people are not really aware of, if they are aware of it, its reputation is quite tricky. It doesn't have much lyricism, it's not a romantic element in it, it's quite a jagged tragedy, but I always felt there was so much stuff in it that was about the world we're in. It's a play that I always think has relevance. Yeah. It's about conflict, about economic uncertainty, continual power play, and the crisis of leadership that goes on and on and on wherever we are.
Well, it's one of the most political plays. I mean, certainly seeing it in your film, you've brought out that political angle more and more, but almost immediate, the mediatized political element of it.
Yeah, well, a lot of that, I have to say, I mean, John Logan, who wrote it, was instrumental in bringing that out. I pitched him the idea of a contemporary Coriolanus, but he then ran with it, and really it was his great sort of flair that sort of let's take essentially the messenger component on the play, people running on and off stage with saying, I've got the latest news from Antium, becomes Jon Snow.
Yeah. I loved that. I thought it was great. The soft who goes here, you can just kind of quieten people. You know, that's what we do now. Who's on telly, really?
And also to have the pundits talking, you know, in the sort of the Jeremy Paxman, Jon Snow interviewing the you know, the people having the commentators.
And your big I banish you moment, which because it's on a TV set, it comes across as political suicide, which of course it is.
That funnily enough, that initially, that was the television studio idea came initially because I'd seen so many photographs of people gathering in football stadiums under protest. In the early drafts, it was a football stadium. We quickly realised that the logistics of that for a financially challenged film would be very hard to pull off. So then I with John, we decided we'd make it a TV studio, and I think it works really well.
But it has that kind of bear-baiting kind of atmosphere, yeah, that political debate sort of has become, yeah, in all those countries.
He's definitely baited by the Tribunes to sort of lose it on camera.
Yeah. You say not many people have heard of Coriolanus. If I must confess that I always have a little freeze on. No, I was in it once.
Well,
my first ever, I was the serf that says, and the line that obtains in your film.
We kept your line in that,
yeah,
film.
we hope to find you our friend and give you our voices heartily.
Okay.
It was my first ever Shakespearean line at the age of 12.
Well, I'm glad we kept that line, yeah, so you had now you have a real connection,
yeah,
with
exactly.
It.
I think he then gets to shout, it's Surf 3, I think he was.
Yeah, really, it was lovely, the Serbian actor who played, yeah, that part.
Yes, and then you get to, because it's an important line, because you say your voice is a lot in,
yeah,
in the continuing,
yeah,
speech.
Yeah, yeah.
So I like to think I
so
cue
you were
up
in it at school?
At school. Yeah, it was my first production at school.
Okay.
So I always remember it, and I always remember being spat at when he surprised you common curs. And it was, and being part of that rabble, I only mention this, not, you know, through, yeah, ego alone, but because I knew from then that being part of a mob was really something quite extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember feeling the realness of both acting and of being in a mob. And that's,
yeah,
exactly what your film has caught, that kind of electric crackle between I suppose hero and mob, and yeah, and the need
the
for
mob
them.
And the, yeah, with the crackle between people, yeah, in a crowd, because that's interesting too.
Mm.
Yeah,
and how much politics needs it. I wondered almost how much, in a way, how much actors need it. A very different relationship. I was pondering this as watching it. The politic, the actors need an audience as much as a politician, but a very different relationship they have with their audience.
Actors' relationship with the audience. Yeah, I always think it's a kind of dialogue, even though the audience is silent in the theatre. It's somehow a dialogue, and now certainly on stage, I feel that there's the degrees of listening are an exchange.
Mm.
So it becomes, you're not as politicians maybe talk at people, but I think there's an interactive quality with actors and audience.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Having now played, I suppose, a consummate, ultimate, yet ultimately hubristic politician in,
yeah,
Coriolanus,
yeah,
is it something that you're... I mean, it's not a pleasant view of politics that your film portrays. Is it something you would ever kind of think of being a politician?
No, I don't know how. I think it must be painful. I mean, I guess there are men and women of great integrity who are politicians, and probably they're the people we hear about least. I mean, there are the people who, to get into certain positions to lead a government department, and the kind of mask you have to put on to win the votes, and then to negotiate within your own party and fight back. I mean, it was a nightmare. But how you hold on to any kind of view of some ideal. You hope there's some ideal there that's about the betterment of things for people, but sometimes they get swamped within their own drama.
Was becoming a director slightly more political than being an actor? I mean, on the day-to-day basis of having to get stuff made, getting funding, as you mentioned, from you know the football stadium. There's a politics at play there.
There is, I suppose there is. You're right. No, this whole bringing together of finance and then the pitching of an idea and inevitably a kind of seduction of people that you want to be involved, but you want it to be genuine. And at the same time, you want to be honest about what it is you're trying to do.
You obviously liked it more than perhaps you knew you would, because you're going to do it again.
I think I am. I'd like to do it again. I found it very rewarding. I mean, of course, it was scary at moments and that was highly adrenalized. But I loved it most because of the relationships I could have with other people in other departments and the sort of creative building of something, uh-huh, whether it was with the designers, Ricky Ayres, or with editor Nick Gaster, and of course with the cast.
And your cameraman.
Well, Barry Aykroyd, yeah, a great cameraman.
Because I was looking at it thinking, well, you know, he's been in so many films, I wonder what elements he'll take from where. But Hurt Locker came to mind almost immediately, and then, of course, I saw his
Funnily enough, I remember I met Ken Branagh, who I wanted to pick his brains at what it meant to be in something, you're playing a lead, directing it, and it being Shakespeare. I remember him saying to me, well, it's your DP. You've got the relationship with the DP is crucial. And with Barry, it became, I hope he would agree, a kind of, you know, we kind of intuitive sense. After a few days, he'd be very open, but he would find stuff, and I would trust he would find stuff. Of course, I would check stuff, but it became a bit of a double act, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many people that helped to make this film that it really is a it is a result of a great collaboration. John Logan, Barry Aykroyd, Nick Gaster, and the cast.
But he's someone that you would think doing Shakespeare. He's a kind of visceral realistic, if you like, in his photography, Barry Aykroyd, and one of my great heroes of cinema.
Yeah, well, I suppose that we had a world that was as real as it could be, you know, conflict zone, crowds on the streets, stuff that I think Barry, coming from documentary, there was an energy in front of him which he could respond to photographically, and where it became a bit more detailed and stiller in terms of, you know, set piece scenes of dialogue between people, then I guess I would, you know, help, I would encourage him to understand what it was. But he didn't know. He knew stuff. I mean, often... but funnily enough, the thing that became the choice that we kept on making with Susanna Lenton, who was the script supervisor, was that the close-up became more and more important as a way to help us understand what's being said. That the expression in the face, if someone's taking you through, you know, five or six sentences of Shakespeare, you need to see the eyes. Yeah. You need to get in.
Yeah. Well, you certainly did. And the blood as well. It was very visceral. And finally, a very big year for you, Rafe. Not only Coriolanus out, your directorial debut, but everything you've touched has come to the cinema now. The Talking Cure is becoming The Dangerous Method. The Gods of Carnage is becoming Carnage. They're all in the film. You couldn't be in them all, possibly.
I wasn't asked to be in them, but that's another conversation.
Well, it's good to see that it all comes good. They're all up against your film. Well, I wish you the best of luck with it. As I say, it's a play close to my heart, and now a film close to my heart as well. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Jason.
A huge thanks to Rafe Fiennes. His Coriolanus is on general release here in the UK from Friday the 20th of January. And that is all for this week. Thanks to all my guests, to Emily Watson and to Zan Brooks, of course. The music we've been featuring on the show this week is the epic score to War Horse by a giant of film composers, John Williams. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.